You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Chairman Mao, Jamie Howe, Ho Chi Minh, Asif Din, Vaclav Havel, Graham Savile, No Surrender, Percy Fender, Guerrilla Cricket.
Good morning, good afternoon, good dawn, good dusk, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Guerrilla Cricket. I'm Guerrilla Hendo, Nigel Henderson, and our special guest today is a man who has played with and against some of the greatest names in the game. In an all-too-brief international career at the start of the century, he scored 100 against England in Mohali, opening for a team with a quite awesome middle order of Dravid, Tendulkar, Ganguly and Laxman. A wicketkeeper batsman, in 2005, he took over Bengal's captaincy in the Ranji Trophy, leading them to a runners-up position in successive seasons. Now a commentator who can be heard on the Hindi and Bengali and English language versions of the IPL, he's also a highly respected coach. Welcome to Guerrilla Cricket. Deep, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you so very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. Now, you know, we're pretty frustrated over here about what's happening with our cricket season. We've had no cricket so far this summer. But in a nation like India, which is so cricket crazy, how on earth is the population coping? Or is cricket being put to the back of people's mind because of COVID?
Fair enough. But it's crazy here because this is usually would be your IPL season. I mean, it would be over by now. Mm. But it would usually be IPL season. And this is the time of the year where nothing happens apart from IPL, these two months. I mean, you know, April, May, a bit of June at times. A lot of highlights have been shown. And the numbers, I gather, for the highlights are pretty good as well. I mean, so people are still watching cricket, even if they're... And there's been a lot of Insta lives and shows like that, you know, recorded and all. So people are still, a lot of people actually, every time I speak to someone, they're like, okay, when are we seeing live cricket again? So people are actually waiting for live cricket to start.
And but has do we think that COVID has passed its peak, or is it still on the way up in India?
Unfortunately, I think it's on its way up as of now. I think the month of June is going to be very, very critical because the lockdown kind of opened the first week of June. So, you know, people are starting to go back to their workplaces and all. Expecting a little spike in the number of cases in this month. But hopefully by the end of this month or beginning of July, there'll be some flattening of that curve.
Right. But what are you hearing? I mean, you're close to the game. As we said, you're an IPL commentator. What are you hearing about the possibility of it being played at all this year? I understand Ganguly sent a letter to state associations yesterday talking about it might be played in empty stadiums. Is that realistic?
I think that is very realistic. If you look at the situation right now, I don't see crowd in the stadium for the next eight months to a year now.
Right.
I think that's the new reality that we have to live with. Stadiums. We can come up with options like, you know, ambience through the PA system or cutouts or Zooms or, you know, LCD TVs. But I don't see crowd at the stadium for a while now till we have vaccines and a major part of the population is vaccinated. As far as the IPL is concerned, I think it's still a possibility because I remember way back in 2009-10, if I'm not wrong, there was an IPL which lasted for 36 or 38, if I'm not wrong.
All right.
So I think there can be a window created because already BCCI has cancelled the Sri Lanka and the Zimbabwe tour. So that opens up a window a little bit. Like September end-ish, right? Now, October last week was, is the World Cup still scheduled, right? Yeah. So you still have a window, even if the World Cup's not cancelled or postponed for that matter, you still might end up getting a window of a month or a little over a month.
What would you say? Would Indian fans like more to see an IPL without crowds or India going and perhaps winning the World T20 in Australia? If you had to choose, I mean, often people say to us in England, would you rather win the World Cup or win the Ashes? What would people in India generally say about that?
So what would you say, the Ashes?
Well, we said the Ashes, but then we also wanted the World Cup. So it's kind of, you know, we sort of stood on the fence about with that one, really, in the end. So after we'd won the World Cup, well, of course, when they suddenly thought, yeah, we want to win the Ashes as well.
Fair enough. But having said that, I guess if you can guarantee that India is going to win the World Cup, then I guess the World Cup. But I guess there are no guarantees that way. So IPL is something... IPL is a little more than cricket. It's just about cricket. It's cricketainment. It's an industry in itself. We tend to kind of look at sports from only a sports perspective. And I think that's a little myopic if you look at through the prism of only sports. Because sports like EPL in England, I mean... Or not just England, world over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an industry in itself. So I think you've got to look at cricket and IPL as industries in itself because it has its own ecosystem. And I think, if you guarantee that that India is going to win the World Cup, then that World Cup. But otherwise, but having said that, you know what? I don't think that's the choice that one needs to make at this point in time. I think both of them, as of now, are still possible. If we can ride over this wave here in India, month of June, as I reckon, and most of the people I've spoken to reckon, if we can ride that wave and be all right by end of July, then, you know, maybe September end, October first week, you can have something, some cricket played here.
It's interesting you talk about it as being an industry. I mean, I understand that if it didn't go ahead, the IPL, the BCCI would lose something like $530 million in terms of... revenue, and I mean that's a huge amount of money, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean it might be more than that. It might just be more than that because you add the sponsors, the central sponsors, you add the rights money and all that. So I mean there are some numbers which are floating around to the tune of a billion actually.
Right. You know, okay.
In terms of rupees, would be 7,000 crores or $1 billion. I don't know about the figures, but yeah, it's a huge amount there. But the other important thing is what people don't really realize is the other industries which are connected, the ecosystem that I was talking about. You have the hotel industry, the airline industry, the hospitality and the events and everything else. So, I mean, it's a huge thing from that perspective. It's not just about the BCCI. It's about all the allied industries as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point, I suppose. The other thought is that it might be moved to another country. I think I saw that being talked about yesterday. And of course, there has been a precedent of that, hasn't there? Because we had, I think it was IPL2 was in South Africa in 2009. How was that for Indian fans? Did it matter that they weren't going to the grounds or weren't be able to pack out the grounds? Is that something that really upsets them?
It does to a certain population, part of the population, but end of the day, I think IPL or 20T20 per se is also a very television friendly format. And I think there is a huge population who love to watch it on the television T20s because of the broadcasting quality, everything else which comes along with watching it on television or any other even digital platform and everything else. So yes, while you might want to actually go and experience that because in itself, it's a huge, I mean, it's a fantastic experience watching it live in a stadium. But you wouldn't mind watching it on television either if you have that chance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's move on from the IPL a little bit and let's talk about you a bit more and your start in cricket. And I noticed on your website that you say you really had to work hard for your success. It's an interesting thing for English fans. We know what the general pathway is now to the England team as it was, or even to one of the first class counties. Yeah. What is it like for a young Indian promising cricketer? How difficult is it for them to make their mark? And how difficult was it for you, really?
Well, I'll be honest. I've never been, and I don't think I've ever been the most talented individual in any playing 11 that I've played. So obviously had to slog it a little more. So, but what I really tried to do was be the most hardworking in any team that I was part of. And because that's the only way I knew how to do it. The other thing you mentioned about the system, I think the good part about like England and like Australia, the system itself is very robust. You know, that's the reason you don't see big transition periods when a generation leaves and a new generation comes in, right? So that's one of the very, very important reasons why a country like India has maintained its position off and on top of the table. So I think from that perspective, so it's like a very filtered and robust system. On top of that, there are certain filters which come naturally for a country like India, a populated country like India with 1.3 billion. Obviously, competition, because as far as sport is concerned, you know, out of five sports, it'll be 1, 2, 3, 4 would be cricket, and then maybe a tennis or a badminton or something else, right? So everyone wants to play for cricket for the country. So competition-wise, yes, then obviously with competition comes a lot of things like selection, because it's a team sport as well, right? It's something that you have to be selected to play. So that brings its own dynamics, you know, selection, selectors, things like that. So there are certain filters which are planned, and there are a lot of unplanned filters as well, which a country like India would understandably have, and they have it. So it is that way tough, because obviously you go through the age groups like 16, 19 and all that. Apart from that, you all a lot of these hurdles where, you know, selectors might not, a particular selector might not like you because you didn't say good morning to him.
Right.
You know, there are personal liking and dislikings as well. And so, you know, there are these hurdles that I guess almost every team sport might have. You know, the coach might not like you, or some selector might not like you, some administrator might not like you. So I guess it's that way stuff. I'm predominantly because of the competition that we have.
Well, we always see that, you know, whenever we see pictures from Mumbai or somewhere like that, we see people on the Maiden, there are all these games going on. But how is it for someone who's playing in one of those games, perhaps, to actually force themselves forward, unless they perhaps go to the, is it as much as going to the right school or being involved with the right club? How difficult is it for someone, you know, at the lower strata of society to make their way? Is it very, very difficult, I imagine?
I don't think it's difficult in terms of your economic background, because I think one of the most equal playing field that you have would be the sport. You know, so I don't think economic background, socio-economic background, or any other for that matter, thing would matter that much. But, you know, like I said, the system is very nice in terms of you start off at a club level or an academy that you practice. From the academies, I'm talking about specifically about Calcutta or Bengal here. So from academies, there's a lot of inter-academy tournaments. From there, you play Division 1 or Division 2 cricket. From there, you get selected to your age group cricket, which you represent your state. So under 16, 19. And then from there, there's a under 23. And then there's the senior first class cricket or senior state cricket. So I think that way it's very well structured. But yeah, the process can be tough. Like I said, depending, you've got to make some very, very important choices. As you mentioned, playing for the right academy, playing for the right clubs, making sure you bowl or you get to bat where you want to, or your stronger suits are. You need people to kind of look at you, because a lot of time what happens is they're good batsmen, but they never get the opportunity to bat in the top three.
Right.
Hence, they don't get enough runs, and because of that, doesn't get noticed. So, you know, things like that keep happening all the time. But that's the reason I think, even though it's structured, but as an individual, you've got to be very, very smart in making those choices.
Well, going back to that that time when you got forced your way into the test side, how was it for you to be opening the batting? You're a wicketkeeper, as we know, and opening the batting, and you've got that middle order lineup behind you. I mean, were you overawed in any way, or had you sort of had enough contact with them before to actually slip into that situation quite comfortably?
So interesting. This is pre-IPL period, right? So
yeah.
The difference between domestic cricket and international cricket is huge. We all know that, right? Yeah. Irrespective of which country you're playing. But pre-IPL, the situation was a little different because obviously because of the international scheduling and stuff, most of these people would not get the time to play domestic cricket.
Right.
So before playing for the country, I had played maybe Srinath once, Zaheer once, Ashish once, Anil once, Haji, everyone once maybe. played against Sachin once, Rahul maybe a couple of times. But I mean, now because of IPL, you get a taste of international cricket even before you play international cricket.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
you know what it's like. But at that point in time, it was, I was awestruck when I first got into that dressing room. I mean, you're looking at Sachin, Rahul, Saurav, because I had played a couple of games and I'd shared the dressing room, so I knew him a little better than the others.
Yeah.
From that perspective, it was. But I think one of the things that I actually have to mention is we all know the names that you mentioned, Anil, Srinath, and obviously the top four batsmen in the middle order. They're all great batsmen. But what I think that they're better human beings than cricketers. You know, so I mean, I had some awesome time with them. They were very, very accepting of any newcomers, not just me. Very open about it. They were very adjusting as well. So I think I didn't have too much of a problem. Yes, initially the first couple of days, it's like, yeah, oh my God, it's Sachin there and it's Saurav there and all that. But yeah, after a couple of days, because I think it was the first day we landed in South Africa, and one of the first things that happened to me was Srinath said, you know, what are you doing for dinner? Let's go out for dinner. So Anil, Srinath, we all went out for dinner.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, that was an icebreaker of sorts and was brilliant after that.
I suppose you have to have a sort of a deep inner confidence. Is that something you would say you had, even if you think to yourself, I'm not the most talented individual and I'm with these incredibly talented individuals, but you've got to have a sort of deep well of confidence, really.
Yeah, I actually did. I think one of the most important things, which I'm sure you heard before us, to sustain yourself or stay there for longer periods at international cricket, yes, your talent is important, but how strong you are mentally, I think that makes a huge difference. You know, one of the things I think I didn't cope up really well with was the criticism. That's something that, you know, a lot of people are not criticism or being told or whatever. So I think those things you learn, but the confidence part, as you mentioned, I mean, obviously once you're there in that dressing room, and what helps is, my first test, I got 30 odd runs, right? And straight away that gave you that confidence.
Right.
You know, that, you know what, it's all right. And the first over or so, it was like, oh, you're playing Sean Pollock. I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Whether I can survive or not? And then you survive the first over, then you say, you know what, I think I can survive. And then you score a few runs, then you start thinking, you know what, I think I can score runs as well. So I think that happens step by step to a certain extent.
Is it the first thing of actually just feeling the ball in the middle of the bat? Is that the thing that suddenly gives you that bit of confidence?
Yeah, I remember my first scoring shot was a cracker of an on drive to Mackay and Atini. And I'll be very honest, I was it was a good length ball. And you know, Mackay and Atini's action was coming back into you, right? I was actually trying to protect my jewels. But I couldn't believe myself how well I timed that shot. I was like, oh my God, that was a good shot.
It's interesting. I mean, I've played at a much lower level, but there are a couple of times you can think back into your playing life and you've no idea how you played the great shot that you played. It's kind of nice to hear that comes in at the top level as well. It's just that something clicked.
I mean, that was my first scoring shot in international cricket. I was like, wow. And honest to God, I mean, it was one of the best shots I've played at that level. So, that kind of gives you confidence as well that, you know, you can score a run. So, yeah, so step by step, I went up there, yeah.
Let's talk about then the match against England in Mahali, and you got your 100 there. What do you remember in particular about that game?
I think I remember the test match before that, which was the second one of the South Africa series. I played a really good knock. I mean, we had to bat through the last day of the test match to save the test match. which Rahul and I batted through almost the whole day, and we saved that test match. So I think I was carrying that one, that confidence into that test match. Secondly, also, you know, at times you're in a zone where nothing else matters. So I was kind of those 3-4 months, I was in that zone where, you know, I was like in a trance kind of a thing. I was just going through the motion and not really thinking too much. One of the things that Rahul told me while we were in that the previous test match was, you know, take one ball at a time, one over at a time, just try and play out a session. And that's all I actually tried to do during that first test at Mohali. Mohali back then was spicier, the pitch there.
Right.
All I tried to do was just take one over at a time, then, you know, maybe half a session, like go till the drinks, then from drinks to the end of the session. And if you look at the number of balls I played, I think I played the whole day, maybe more than a day. So I wasn't too worried about scoring runs. I was like, you know what, I just want the batters need to be out here.
And what do you feel? For those of us who haven't got to experience this amazing feeling, getting to three figures in a test match and quite early in your test career, and obviously we didn't know how long that was going to go on, but
yeah.
What was that feeling like, getting those three figures?
Oh, that was phenomenal, actually. I mean, phenomenal in the sense you have that sense of belonging, because, I mean, any team that you enter, one of the first things that you want is, you know, the acceptance and acknowledgement from your peers, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, I got a lot of that from the previous innings that I played. But once you get that 100, that's like if you're playing in a team as a batsman, wicketkeeper, that's one of the boxes that you want to tick as a batsman, you know?
Yeah.
Getting 100, you know? So I think that was a huge thing, and also getting 100, not too many wickets have done that for India in test match cricket. So then you start, you know, all my life what I did was I would, as I mentioned, I would take one step at a time. So when I was first picked for the zone, I started thinking, you know what, I'm one of the top 8 wicketkeeper batsmen in the country. Then when I was picked for the next level, I was like, you know, I'm one of the, you know, top one top wicketkeeper out of the 4 in the country. Because we were picked for a camp. There were only 4 wicket keepers in that camp. So, and then when I got that 100, I was like, you know what? Not too many wicket keepers have got 100. So, I'm making a name for myself.
Right.
So, I think those things started sinking in. And then, obviously, that confidence level started going up. Saying, you know, I think I can. Because a lot of my teammates said, you know what? You keep going this way, you will be around for a while. Mm. And, yeah, and that's something that gave me a lot of confidence.
Well, it's interesting. You touch on being, you know, one of the 8 best wicketkeeper batsmen in the country. We've obviously had a discussion, or we've often had a discussion in this country about how difficult it is to open in a test match and also keep wicket. I mean, how was that for you? That's a hell of a lot of responsibility when you first come into a side.
It was. And I think I was asked if I would open in the second test match, because the first test match in South Africa, Rahul opened, and then the second, Rahul's like, you know what, I want to bat at number 3. That's my position. And then before the second test match, I think eve of the second test match, Saurav asked me if you want to open. I was like, listen, I can bat anywhere as long as I'm playing. I'm ready to bat anywhere. He said, okay, then, you know, open. Because in the first test match, I had actually batted against the second new ball, and I did all right. So they saw that in me. So I said, yeah, I mean, as long as I'm playing, I wouldn't mind batting anyway. So I opened. You know, how I see it is, if you are physically strong and mentally strong, then the other aspect becomes a little easier. Because as a wicketkeeper, if I've kept wickets on a surface for 80 overs, I know that surface better than anyone else.
Right.
You know, the bounce, the turn, the pace of the pitch, I know it better than anyone else. It's just the problem is whether physically am I fatigued, mentally whether I'm fatigued or not. So, yeah, my career was only 2-3 years.
Mm.
Maybe if I played longer, I would have had to take it. I mean, I had to choose then, like someone like Sangha did. You know, he chose to bat top order and leave wicket keeping.
Yeah.
So, I think in the long run, it becomes very difficult. But yeah, for a couple of seasons or 2-3 years, I think it's doable. And especially if you're in your early 20s.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, you went on to captain Bengal, and I'm not quite sure without looking through all the previous scorecards. Were you doing the 3 jobs then, captaining, opening and keeping wicket?
I actually was batting at number 6. But
right.
Then, you know, when Saurav could be then our middle order was packed. So we had to make space at times. So I would open then. So for example, the second year, the finals I opened against Mumbai. So yeah, I mean, I was happy to kind of, I was more flexible in my approach, depending on what the team required. And because my philosophy is, listen, if I want somebody to take the bullet for the side, I would be the first one to do it, you know. So if there was a situation where somebody had to kind of maybe call it sacrifice or whatever, I think I would want to be the first one to do it. And maybe that would set an example for the others.
And what's it like then being, I suppose, captain of a team in which Sourav Ganguly is playing after you've been used to him as a captain at international level?
In my first game, the team sheet, I've got it framed because it said Deep Das Gupta, captain, and the second name is Sourav Ganguly. That's for my grandchildren, actually.
Yes, so. Absolutely. Yes. Well, that's lovely. That's lovely. Let's move on and talk about Sourav Ganguly, who's relatively recently become the BCCI president. I suppose with guerrilla cricket, we're always looking to expand the game. We're always talking about the game globally, something that our listeners and viewers are very, very interested in. I think initially when Ganguly took on the role, he's actually talking about India getting more of the money that's being generated because India does actually generate that revenue. Would that, in your view, does that harm the development of the game? I mean, is that something that we should be resisting? Should we be trying to widen the boundaries a little bit?
It is important to widen the boundaries. I think we need to figure out how. Because, I mean, unlike a lot of sports, we have three formats.
Yeah.
Right? We've got three formats and not just men. We've got women's cricket as well. So I think there are two aspects to this. One is obviously the financial side of it. And I was talking to one of the ICC people because this was, and I spoke to this gentleman around 2 years ago when the number of teams that were playing the 50 over one day, the World Cup came down to 10. And there was a huge debate about whether it should come down and all that. And he said, listen, there are ways that we need to find out to kind of spread the game. Because unlike football, if you take football to a new country, FIFA makes money, right? But in cricket, when ICC takes sport to a different country, it's ICC who has to give the grant. So it's ICC losing money. So somewhere it needs to be compensated, right? So, you know, unlike other sports, it's the other way around. It's where ICC has to fund the new countries or the new teams or associate countries and all. So I think from that perspective, it's very, very important to keep in mind of boards which actually can compensate for the growth of the sport to other countries. So I think there has to be a fine balance between, you know, making in the money, getting it commercially viable to spread the sport to other parts as well.
Do you think though, I mean, we've moved on a little bit from the notion of the big three from a couple of years ago when, you know, India, Australia and England were accused of sort of creating this cabal. Do you think that we can move on beyond that and absorb more teams into the game in general?
I think we can. We definitely can. But again, like I said, we have to find the right balance between generating the finances to spread the sport. Mm. We need to figure out what's the right vehicle to spread the sport as well. In my opinion, I think women's cricket is the best vehicle to spread the sport. I mean, I don't think you find a better vehicle than women's cricket right now.
Right.
You know, spread it, I mean, beyond the Commonwealth countries.
Yeah.
I honestly think there has to be more countries involved. Mm. That's where I think when this whole Test Championship came in, I think it's a great idea. But I also believe that if there can be two-tier Test Championship, you know, top six in group one and the other six in group two, then what happens is the other sides like Afghanistan, Ireland, they don't have to depend on the others. You know, they don't have to depend on the top three to, you know, when are you going to give us a series?
I suppose there's that, but then there is also the notion that if they do get to play one of the big teams, financially that could be very important for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not denying that. And I actually had a plan, or I still have a plan, where you play 10 test matches in a year against based on the TP, and then you add another 2-3 because on an average, I mean, England definitely plays more test matches in a cricket season than anyone else, around 16-17. But on an average, every country plays around 13-14 test matches. So you play 10 based on the FTP, and then you play 2-3 extra, where you actually go on and kind of play against, let's say, the new and upcoming countries like Afghanistan or Ireland, play a couple of test matches and help them out as well. Because the other important thing is test match. One of the reasons I believe people are losing or test matches losing viewership is the competition. There are too many bilateral series where it's, I mean, there's not too much of competition, you know. I mean, if I give you a choice between England, Australia, England, India, or let's say England, Zimbabwe, you know, so for me, I think it's important to actually you play, I mean, the other sides play against the top 3, 4, 5 sides in the world. But it's also important that, you know, you keep the viewership alive and you keep people following Test cricket alive by making it more competitive.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we covered the Ireland's inaugural Test against Pakistan, and we also were involved in a game that Nepal played at Lord's. And it's good to see those teams involved, and especially Nepal, which has again just been granted back into the ICC, of course, had some problems at one point. Yeah. I mean, the love for cricket there is phenomenal.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. And that's where I think the other countries, rather than, I mean, they can support countries like Nepal, Afghanistan with infrastructure, with sending in cricketers and coaches, getting them to come over and here against, let's say, the India A side or the England A side, the tour. Yeah. Because the idea is there's no point. I mean, once in a while you play, Nepal plays against England, it's fine. It looks very nice and all that. But actually, are they learning anything? I mean, England scores 350 and they're all out for 120, 130. They're not learning anything out of that. They rather play England A or maybe the England Lions, which you call A side, the Lions. They play the Lions and the games are more competitive. And they actually learn something. And that's how you improve a side. It looks nice. You're giving them grants and everything else. But you don't want them to be on crutches all their lives. You've got to take the crutches away. And one of the ways you can take those crutches away is making them self-sufficient by helping them with the grassroots level and the infrastructure there.
So that means maybe putting money into helping develop grounds and things like that. In if you take Nepal for an example,
absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean even in countries where the players are struggling to make a living, I suppose you talk about the West Indies coming over to England, but they're really not going to make a huge amount of money from that. I mean, is there a role for the ICC in funding those countries which have slipped a little bit and need to be brought back up to a better level in some respects? Is there a role for the ICC in that?
I think yes. I definitely think yes. ICC and through the ICC, boards like BCCI, the Cricket Australia, ECB. I think obviously these three boards and also add Cricket South Africa in there as well has to help. There's no two ways about it. Because obviously look at Zimbabwe right now. Back when I was playing international cricket, I played a series against them. They were a gun side.
Yeah.
They were a really, really good side, early 2000, late 90s and early 2000. Yeah. I mean, they've slipped from there and they slipped because, again, I mean, they don't have that structure there. So one thing is obviously financially helping them and making them secure. And also, like I mentioned before, I mean, if you're giving money to someone, you also have to make sure that the money is spent the right way.
Yeah,
a lot of times I know money's been given to all countries and associate countries and all, but maybe they're not used the way they should be.
Yeah, there's always a problem with politics in cricket, isn't there? It's about who the people are involved and what their own motivations for being involved are. I mean, it's a controversial subject, I suppose, in some respects. But even more perhaps controversial this week was the comment by Darren Sammy about his experience in the IPL. And you obviously talk Hindi, and there was this particular, he didn't know it was an insult at the time. He thought he was being called Stallion. What are your feelings about that? How did you feel about that? And how has that been seen in India, the fact that he came out with those comments?
I think we realize that there is this casual racism, so to say, in Southeast Asia. Because there are a lot of things that we say which it's not. See, how the Western world looks, racism is a little different from how maybe Asia or Southeast Asia looks at it.
Right.
And obviously it's layered. it's not as, because our society is so layered. So it's like a country like India, they're like, you can actually find good 6-7 countries within India. So yeah. Obviously, I mean, we're definitely not happy about it. It would be justified by any stretch of imagination. But there's something that obviously everyone's looking inward now and needs to look inward and say, you know what, it's time to start looking at these casual words that we use, which might not be right. As far as Darren Sammy not knowing the meaning of it, I'm not too sure about that. I saw a tweet, he tweeted way back in 2014, wishing someone happy birthday, and he mentioned something. So I'm not too sure whether he did not know the meaning. I find that a little strange, but again, not justifying the use of the word.
You mentioned that word in a tweet to you, you're saying?
Yeah, he did that. He did that. I saw a tweet way back, I think, I'll tell you the date, I think 1st November 2014.
Okay, that's interesting to know. Yeah, it's become a sort of a more high profile situation. We've had various people in this country, Michael Carberry, recently talking to one of the podcasts about the way that black people are seen in cricket now. Let's move on from that to more pleasant things in a way.
One thing,
oh, just yes, of course.
Quickly, one thing. I mean, I know, I mean, Mark Carberry mentioned about it, obviously Dan Sammy mentioned about it, but yeah. I tell you what, India, at least I can speak for India, one of the most secular, equal places that you can find is the cricket field or the sports field. Right. You know, so I mean, I don't know. Like I said, I mean, it's part of the society that, like I said, we're not happy about it, and it's time for us to kind of introspect.
Okay, let's talk about your coaching career, because I think that's what you've embarked on a lot. Tell us a little bit about that and where you've been involved.
Oh well, I've been involved with the Cricket Division of Bengal, which is the Bengal first class side, as a consultant coach. I've coached the India under 23 way back in 2013-14. Then the media career happened, and then because I've always been a passionate coach, I've always been passionate about coaching, because I think it's fun. You see a kid, you say something to a kid, and the kid starts doing well. That gratification it's unbelievable. But having said that, because of the media commitments and all, I can't give too much of time to coaching. So one of the reasons. One of the things that I've done in the last couple of months is start my own website with online coaching called deepdasgupta.com, and it's open to everyone and anyone. So I don't have to be physically there. So I could be doing an India-England series, and in the evening I can actually look at the videos and send my suggestions or advice through online.
It's just incredible, isn't it, really, when you think of the technological advances, because, you know, the notion that when I was younger, that the idea that I could actually talk to an ex-test cricketer or get some coaching tips, you know, you might get that if you were lucky enough to sort of, there was some sort of open day at your county or something like that. But the notion that you could actually have that concentrated focus from, you know, a world-class coach is an astonishing feeling.
It is. See, what used to happen was a lot of people would send me videos of their kids and all. I was like, you know, I would anyway send it back to them. But now, you know, I was working with a friend of mine who's based out of England, actually. And one of my first coaching experiences was in England. I got my badge from Middlesex, my level ones with Phil Knappett. He was the instructor there. One of my first gigs was in England. So this software is like... about video analysis, right? So he's like, you know, I've come up with this. And I was thinking the last 2 months, you know, I can use that. So I started asking my friends or people who would send me videos, like, you know, send me through this app or whatever. And it was fun. It was fun. And it was great, actually. So I said, okay, let's turn it into a guide. And then one thing led to the other. And now I have this website now.
It's almost like you're having the best of both worlds here. I was going to say to you, media or coaching, would you have to make a decision on that? But it seems like you don't have to.
I don't have to, no. I really don't have to choose now.
Does that mean that you are, I suppose, holding back your ambitions in coaching? I mean, have you ever thought about going on to the, you know, the national level of being an India coach one day, perhaps?
I'm holding on to it, I'll be very honest, because one, I love my job as a commentator, because you know, that's the best job in the world. You all your life, all you've done is play the game. Now all you have to do is watch the game, talk about it, sit in an AC room. You don't even have to be outside, right?
Yeah.
You travel the world. You commentate with your role models. You're sitting there with Kapil Dev, Sunil Gavaskar, Sanjay Manjrekar, all these guys. And having a ball of a time, Ian Bishop and all these guys, and Nasser and all. It's just unbelievable. But yes, coaching being my passion. The other important thing is, if you take coaching seriously, which I once I get into, obviously I would, the amount of, the number of days that you have to stay away from home obviously increases.
Yeah, yeah.
And having a young family, I've got two kids, 15 and 12, that, at this point in time, that makes it a little more difficult. So I'm like, yeah, I'm all right. I'm trying to keep myself fit. Maybe in 4 or 5 years' time, and kids grow up a little bit more, then I'll get on the road.
That's interesting you say about the fact that you go around the world and you're on these different grounds. Of course, if you know Guerrilla Cricket, we basically sit in a room in Southeast London and watch the telly. Every now and again, they let us out. But absolutely, I know what you mean. The feeling that we had when we were covering the Ireland-Pakistan test from the ground, I mean, it's just beautiful, isn't it? Being there at sort of 8 o'clock in the morning and just sort of seeing the players practice or whatever.
Absolutely. I mean, just go out there on the field, just look at the pitch and the players warming up and all. That's a different feel. And that's why I'm saying, I mean, as a commentator, we've got the best job in the world, to be honest. I mean, can't get better than this.
Well, you mentioned Nasser Hussain, and we covered a game 2 years ago. I think it was for Hurricane Relief, the West Indies T20 at Lord's. And Nasser Hussain, it was one of the most hilarious things I've ever seen. He basically commentated from the middle. So he would be almost fielding at third slip while with a microphone in his hands. I mean, is that going a bit far? I'm one of those people who's a bit of a traditionalist, and I don't really like interviews with players halfway through the game or talking to them like they do in some of the T20 tournaments. Do you think that's going too far, or do you think that's more engagement, really?
I think we are lucky to have three different formats. So you always have T20. Which is more viewer-friendly and broadcast-friendly, and you can try out a few things there. And I'm with you as far as test match cricket is. Listen, you've got one-day cricket, you've got T20, do whatever. Don't touch test match cricket. I mean, I'm a purist from that perspective. Like, test match cricket, that's one thing that we've got as sacrosanct. Don't touch that. You do whatever with T20. I'm more than happy. But something that you mentioned, something that I thought would always be a good idea, is the communication between the coach and the captain.
Right.
I think that's something I know it was tried by Bob Woolmer back in, I think, late 90s or early 2000 with Hansi Kroni as a coach. I think that makes sense. You know, I think coaches need to be a little more hands-on. Cricket is a very, very captain-oriented or captain-focused game. I think coach needs to kind of get into the picture a little more, especially in T20. I mean, T20 coaches don't really have too much of a role apart from organizing net sessions and practice sessions. So maybe put a mic and a earphone and connect the captain and the coach from the outside. Maybe that might help.
I'm just wondering, there's one problem with that, of course, is in maybe not so much in T20, but the notion of a coach being able to say to his captain, you should review that. That's the problem, isn't it, with regards to that? There's some sort of safeguard's got to be put in to prevent that, hasn't it? Or is should that be allowed, really?
I don't have a problem. I mean, listen, you bring that down from 15 seconds to 10 seconds and say, okay, do it now.
Yeah.
You know, you can. I mean, just make it tougher. Make it tougher. I mean, you can think about it. See, I'm like I said, I mean, as long as you don't touch the basics of test match cricket, you can always introduce new things. And also make maybe test match cricket a little more viewer friendly. Because as it is, it's getting difficult, right? I mean, nobody has, to be very, very honest, time to sit over for 5 days from 11 to 6, 7 back in England or 9 to 5 here in India. If some things can be introduced without touching the fundamentals, because, I mean, a couple of years ago, people started talking about, why don't we get rid of the toss? And I was like, listen, that's so fundamental about the sport. I mean, how can we get rid of the toss? I mean, add other things. Add like, okay, I mean, the team loses the toss can make one change after the toss is done, you know, depending on whether you're batting or bowling first. I mean, but don't play with the fundamentals is what I'm saying. I mean, there are some basic fundamentals about test match cricket, and I'd say don't touch them.
Yeah, that's fine about tests. I mean, we had the situation in England where they did allow the away team in county cricket to have first decision on what they wanted to do. I don't know whether that was the right one or not. I mean, talking about fundamentals in cricket, the ball. Let's talk about the ball, because I think you've been quite outspoken in regards to ball tampering. And I think, if I'm not wrong, you think that should be allowed. Does that also become more important in this particular era where we have the threat of COVID and we're not going to have saliva being put on the ball, subject, of course, to run penalties and whatever? Does that make that even more important, more crucial?
I think it does. And when I say legalized ball tampering, which you're mentioning, I'm not saying get stuff from the outside, like, you know, bottle caps and stuff like that.
Yeah,
I mean, something like nails or something, you know, you can use nails, your own fingernails, that is, things like that. I mean, you know, your thumb and, I mean, because I see it as an art, to be honest. Right. I mean, if you can actually take off the upper layer with your fingernails, I mean, you've got to really strong nails and strong fingers to do that. I mean, right. that for me is could be, I mean, is as good as any art form. So things like that. And now, especially now, I think they have to think about it. I mean, the playing conditions which have recently come out, I don't see a full stop after that. I see a comma. Mm-hmm. I think it's theoretically all right, but we need to find out if it's practical or not. All those five changes that are coming in, you might see a few more is what I reckon. See, if you're playing in England and you can't use saliva, I don't know. I mean, you take one of the most important weapons out of their armory. You know, and you haven't given anything back to them. My point is, okay, I understand. I completely agree that at this point in time, you shouldn't allow saliva. Yeah. But you've got to give something back to them. Maybe use the ball. You can change the ball after 40 overs. You get a new ball after 40 overs. Or you can use Vaseline or something like that. You know, something on those lines. You've got to give something back to the bowlers if you've taken something as important as that and as basic as that.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting point. Let's just wrap up by talking about what's going to happen in the next few months. I mean, well, we're obviously getting quite excited here because we've got the potential of the England-West Indies series and then perhaps England-Pakistan to come after that. Because of the lack of cricket, of the live cricket or cricket that's being played at the moment in India, is there going to be an extra focus on watching that England-West Indies series, do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Because the timing is also spot on. If you look at, I mean, 11 a.m. start there back in England, it would be 3:30 here in India. And that's like bang into your time. So, yes, I mean, no live cricket for 3 months. Everyone's waiting for it. And also to look at how with these new conditions, playing conditions and how, I mean, the players cope up with it. I mean, how do things change? For example, you can't apply saliva, but if somebody does by mistake, you've got to clean it. How are you going to clean it? You can't clean it with a towel, right? You're going to clean it with a disinfectant, which maybe a sanitizer or something. What's the effect of the sanitizer on the body? You know, how is that going to affect?
Now, that is an interesting idea in COVID land, isn't it? Having the notion of putting hand sanitizer on the ball.
Yeah. So you talking about, I can't imagine somebody spraying the ball and then you never know. I mean, if somebody realizes that using a sanitizer actually helps in reversing or something, then you don't mind giving away 5 runs, do you? If the ball starts reversing.
I suppose that's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it'd be fascinating to see.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to looking at how both these teams go around. You know, in these new playing conditions.
Yeah, I mean, as an ex-player, and if you were playing now, I mean, how do you think you would feel? Would you feel, we've got this idea of having now COVID substitutes, but if someone goes down with the illness or tests positive for the illness halfway through a game, or, you know, even a day or two into the game, is it right that you continue the game with a substitute? Shouldn't everyone be immediately tested and perhaps the game brought to a halt?
So there's this doctor who got in touch with me and he says, you know, the WHO protocol says that if somebody is found positive, then everyone who's come in touch with that person has to go into quarantine and need to get tested.
Yeah.
So I completely agree. I mean, I don't know. That's the reason I said theoretically. I mean, theoretically, everything sounds all right. But we need to see the practicality of all these playing conditions that has come out. The other thing, I was talking to someone and someone's, I mean, he came up with this great idea. It's like, you know, why are we starting with the five, a test match? Why not start with T20 and ODI? Mm. you know, because it's comparatively, I won't say, I mean, over 5 days, you don't know. I mean, the uncertainties are little, I mean, in terms of bigger as compared to a 3-hour game. You know what I'm saying? Maybe should have started with T20, but you know what? I'm not complaining as long as I see live cricket now.
See some cricket. Well, it's been brilliant talking to you, Deep. Thanks very much for giving us your time. Are you planning to come over to England at some point in the not too distant future?
Yes, I am actually. I've got family there. I spend a month and a half almost every summer back in England. So yeah, I mean, this summer didn't work out. So let's see. Definitely next summer. Fingers crossed. Maybe before that as well.
Brilliant. Okay, it's been fantastic to talk to you, Deep. Keep in contact with us. We'll hopefully talk to you through Cricket Tracker or various other things as well. And good luck for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Guerrilla Cricket.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.